Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's January 7th, 2020. The reason I'm mentioning the date, I don't usually do that, is we're only 7 days into the year, and I'm already exhausted by it. I think I said that yesterday, but I'm even more exhausted by it. But today marks a special day because this is the one-year anniversary of the launch of the full Bulwark site, which I still find remarkable because in Trump world is like dog years times two. So 1 year in Trump time is about 10 years. But January 7th, 2019, we launched the Bulwark. I mean, fully formed. And I have to say that even being part of it, I'm still amazed that this happened. Because you look at the calendar, the Weekly Standard was murdered, effectively shut down by its owners, on December 14th. And the staff of the Bulwark was basically the core digital staff of the Weekly Standard. And so, in just a little more than 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, we put together this team, we put together the site, we designed it, and we were up and running from day one, and we hit the ground running and have been going for the last year. And I was just doing a count yesterday with some of the folks at the Bulwark, and we estimate sort of roughly that we've published more than 1,000 original articles. We've had close to 300 of these podcasts. We've now launched a new podcast with Mona Charon, which you should definitely check out. We have 3 daily newsletters right now. So we probably have put out somewhere between 700, 800, 900 daily newsletters. So whether you're talking about short, snarky takes or some really deep dives, it's been an amazing year. And I think what I'm most proud of is the way that the Bulwark stepped into the breach after the death of the Weekly Standard. And we tested the proposition whether or not there was going to be a market for center-right, center-left commentary. And we have really added to the team over the years a wide range of contributors. You know, everything from, you know, solid conservatives, you know, going way back to the beginning movement conservative, and I consider myself one of those, to people who are on the center left, people like Richard North Patterson, Molly Jong Fast. And this, of course, has confused a lot of people. Who are you? Why are you doing all of this? Well, we are trying to be a smart, non-tribal voice in this era, and I have to tell you, I'm incredibly proud. We're going to continue doing this. Our second year, I think, is going to be even stronger. 2020 is going to be absolutely off the hook. We will continue to rely upon the kindness of strangers. We are not putting up a paywall. We are not charging. We're going to stay free and feisty, and we are incredibly grateful for your support. And I was really also struck as I'm looking at the page today, on our 1 year anniversary, how strong the content has been and the diversity of content. You know, we have Philip Rotner writing how Rudy Giuliani got Trump impeached. We have a brother-in-law of Boris Johnson, and I kid you not, a brother-in-law of Boris Johnson writing for the Bulwark about how the big lie has come to British politics. We have Stephen Waldman writing about the 4 lies that Trump tells evangelical Christians. We have Shay Kateri on the president's apparent threat to bomb cultural sites, illegal, barbaric, and foolish. We have somebody with deep roots in the Watergate investigations, James Robinault. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If there are witnesses, the Senate can compel them. And recounting the story about how Senator Sam Ervin had decided that he was not going to take no for an answer when it came to getting Alexander Butterfield to testify about the White House taping system. We know how that turned out. We have a piece by Desmond Lackman, The 2020 Economy, How It Could Be Bad for Trump and the Rest of Us. And Brian Stewart has one of the best, most balanced takes on what's going on in the Middle East, how killing Soleimani creates danger and opportunity. So between the podcasts, the newsletters, the short takes, but also the deep dives, I think the Bulwark has accomplished something in 1 year that we never could have imagined. And I will tell you that when we launched this on January 7th, 2019, we did not know what to expect. We did not know how long we were going to be around. We did not know whether or not there was going to be an audience. We did not know, whether or not, you know, writers and journalists would want to contribute. And what has happened, and I've said this over and over again, has exceeded our wildest expectations. And I want to thank all of the people who've contributed money, but also those who've contributed their thoughts and their ideas to the Bulwark, and to all of the guests that we've had on this podcast. We have we've had more than 8.3 million downloads, and I've said this before. Early on, I made a list of the people that I wanted to talk with on this podcast, and to a person, we have talked to every single person that I wanted to talk to. And one of our regular and earliest guests, was David Priest from, Lawfare Blog, one of our friends from Lawfare Blog. And David joins us again on the seventh day of the new decade. So David, welcome back to the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. And let me say, it has been a pleasure to write for the Bulwark, to come on the podcast, to chat with you and others about these ideas. And all I can say is keep it going. This is a great forum for thoughtful discussion of issues for people who care about the rule of law and the future of our country, and let's keep the ball going.
Well, we certainly intend to. And again, I want to remind people, if you haven't subscribed to our newsletters, we have three a day. I put out one in the morning shots. Jonathan Last has one midday, The Triad, and Jim Swift puts out a late afternoon email. And of course, the Bulwark Podcast, which you can subscribe to wherever they have good podcasts. Okay. So David, I really wanted to talk to you today. Yeah. You have reminded our listeners of your background, working with the FBI, working with the CIA, what you used to do. Because I want to talk about, a couple of things that happened in the news. So just remind us of your resume, on this. Yep. before we dive into this.
I'll do something even before that, Charlie. It's not often that as we're recording the podcast, I get to break news for you. So I am going to take that option today. As we are recording this podcast, the federal government has announced that it is closing early. All federal offices in the Washington, D.C. area will be closing at 1 p.m. because of, get this, you will appreciate this like me from the upper Midwest, because of a coating to 2 inches of slushy snow, probably on grassy areas.
2 inches.
So therefore, the government is shutting down. I mean, we may not need massive foreign intervention in our country. We may not need terrorist acts. We might just need some slushy snow to shut the government down.
You know what 2 inches of slushy snow is in Wisconsin?
Tuesday. A pleasant break.
Tuesday. Yeah. It's just nothing.
Okay. Back to me. I worked at the CIA and the State Department, worked on issues largely in the Middle East and counterterrorism at both department and agency. And one of my jobs was to be the daily intelligence briefer for the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, and the FBI Director, Bob Mueller, for a little over a year, as well as occasionally briefing at the White House, the President's Daily Brief, and others. So that's where I process a lot of my national security news and looking at all of this and having researched extensively by interviewing all of the living former presidents and vice presidents and CIA directors for my first book, getting a sense of how the national security process works based both on my experience and on their experiences, helps me to give some historical perspective on the things we're seeing and whether they are normal or not.
And it distinguishes you from many of the talking heads who suddenly have these hot takes that we're seeing in the wake of the killing of General Soleimani. So you tweeted out a thread the other day. Let me just read the first tweet. Soleimani's death by itself might make the U.S. safer. He was a figure of immense importance and influence. But any "we are safer" judgment from this targeted killing requires a calculation of greater benefits from his death than costs from predictable after effects. So let's talk about this, because this I think is a nuanced take that the world is better off. This was a bad guy. We are not mourning his loss. But, is there a strategy behind it? And on balance, are we safer? So give me your take on this.
Yeah, let's separate out two things, because they're being conflated in a lot of the discussion, which is was this legal and was this wise? People who are out there saying, yeah, based on the accumulation of power in the presidency, it probably was legal, are almost immediately accused of saying, well, why are you supporting the president? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the same as saying the policy is wise. If you want to break down on the pure legal side, putting aside the policy side, at Lawfare, we just put out a special podcast last night featuring Scott Anderson of Lawfare and Brookings, Bobby Chesney of UT Austin Law School, Jack Goldsmith of Harvard Law School, Ashley Deeks of UVA Law School, Sam Moyne of Yale Law School, all of them breaking down the law. But let's put that aside for now. I want to talk about policy, and it's national security decision-making.
Well, before that, we get to that. So was the consensus of that group that this was legal? If not wise, was it legal?
Yeah, they focused largely on U.S. domestic law.
Okay.
And in U.S. domestic law, there have been multiple justifications put out there, whether it rests on the president's Article II authority, whether it rests on the authorization for use of military force, or whether it was purely preemption of an imminent threat. Those have all been put out there by various administration officials, but all of them do have some history of being just fine by domestic law.
Okay, what about international law?
International law is a little bit fuzzier because at one level you have the international law of the use of force in another country against a third country just doesn't seem to fly. On the other hand, if the justification is that there was an imminent attack, that is the exception even under the UN whereby a country can use force overseas. Now, there is also the thorny issue of, well, what about in Iraq? Because it doesn't appear that the consent of the Iraqi government was obtained before doing this. So they have a great discussion on this based on combined over 100 years of experience analyzing national security law. For me, I look at the national security decision-making part of this. And in a normal administration, huge caveat, in anything, even 10% of this momentous. And I say that being generous because there were many decisions that I was a part of that went up to senior levels of the U.S. government for decision making. And they were over very low stakes compared to this, like an arms sale to an ally or whether to start negotiating a certain kind of treaty. Even on those, the paperwork that goes up through all of the agencies and departments into the National Security Council process involves, here is what the United States national security would gain if this happens. Here is what the national security of the United States would lose if it doesn't happen. And then here's what would happen in the middle. And it's essentially a cost-benefit analysis, although it's not always presented in those stark terms. But there's almost always an analysis of, here is what we're trying to get. Here is what we're trying to get by doing something. And here's what we stand to lose if we do that thing. So let's look at Soleimani. The administration has put out there that there was an imminent attack coming and Soleimani somehow was crucial to it, such that killing him mattered. And they put out there that, well, now Iran is going to think twice about attacking us or supporting attacks on us, and maybe they'll be less aggressive overall. Okay, those are possible. I'm not sure either of those is solid, but they're possible. But let's look at the predictable after effects. Let's look at the cost side. Well, we did take out Soleimani, and there's no doubt he was a bad hombre. I mean, he was responsible for planning and for supervising some heinous attacks that included deaths of American citizens. He is one member of an organization of many thousands of people who don't take their attack plans and throw them away because the commander was killed. And the attack did not take out any of those other people who have been working for decades in the Quds Force. They're all still there. Plus, the strike has led to some things like today, NATO deciding it's going to pull out some forces from Iraq, the U.S. all but closing its embassy in Baghdad, including shutting down consular services and telling Americans, get out of the country any way you can, driving over land if you need to, as if, what, they're going to go to Iran or Syria to get out of Iraq. That's not exactly making most Americans safer. The one that got me, of course, was that the U.S. announced shortly after the Soleimani strike that the United States government has felt compelled to halt its operations in Iraq against ISIS, the thing that has been held up as the ultimate threat, even by the president going into this election. Wow. You put that in along with Iran announcing it's going to restart its uranium enrichment. Those are a lot of predictable consequences to an act.
So you
that,
think
again,
though, you
may
think,
have
you,
been imminent.
Yeah, you think those were foreseeable, that this blowback absolutely was foreseeable, it was predictable, and that people in the U.S. intelligence community would have been able to warn the president, had he listened to them, that if you do this, this will be the consequence.
Yeah, let me mm-hmm. split that into mm-hmm. two. One is the intelligence. I haven't seen the intelligence. I'm not privy to it anymore. But for something of this magnitude, this is exactly the kind of thing that a usual administration would get an intelligence assessment on. Now, if it's very highly secretive, and I was involved in a couple of those where there was something, a proposed covert action that was so secretive that they limited it literally to a handful of people and said, look, we're going to put you six people in a room. You're going to analyze the potential consequences of this dramatic action were the president to authorize this covert action. And we will feed that up the process. That happens to figure mm-hmm. that out. Mm-hmm. You also have the policy advisors. For the wisdom of an action, you don't just take what the intelligence assessment puts out there. You actually have the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, probably people in the intelligence community, certainly the National Security Advisor, all telling the president, Mr. President, here's what will happen diplomatically if we do it. Mr. President, here's what will happen to our military operations if we do it. If that didn't happen, that is bad government. That is a probably, I would put it at the level of dereliction of duty, that the government would take an action of this magnitude without calculating those consequences and having a serious discussion of them. Did that happen? It's possible. I said that maybe there was a robust calculation of all of these potential consequences, and they actually weighed the benefits and the costs, but we have not seen a single sign of that. In fact, most of the information we're getting suggests that it was an option presented to Trump among others. He picked it and said, we're doing it. And in fact, some of these justifications have come afterward. That is not a healthy national security decision-making process, regardless of how you feel about Soleimani's presence on this earth.
But it is forceful. And of course, the president continues to tweet out various, you know, don't even think about retaliating. We'll get to the, you know, attacks on cultural sites. Is there a possibility that, in fact, this action and the president's rhetoric and his clear willingness to use force might actually act as a deterrent to some of the adventurism that we've seen from the Iranians?
Absolutely. It is a possibility, and I'll leave it at that. I don't have the access to the intelligence to know the Iranian decision-making at this point, to know what it looks like from their point of view. But it is certainly a possibility that Iranian leaders will say, hey, look, if this president is willing to do this with all of these predictable consequences, we can't rationally calculate what he's going to do next. Mm-hmm, we'd better mm-hmm. back off until at least November. That is a possibility. I don't think it's likely, but I think it's a possibility. Now, the other side of it is, let's look at the things that have already happened. Yes, maybe Iran will be less aggressive when it comes to, I don't know, sending people to storm the embassy. Mm-hmm. But they have announced they're restarting uranium enrichment. They have essentially removed, if not removed, U.S. forces from Iraq. They have frozen U.S. forces in Iraq where they are, so such that they're not out doing operations. They have, in effect, shut down NATO and allied operations in Iraq, or come close to doing so. Americans across the region are being warned about threats. Yeah. So what is the cost from it? Even if it encourages Iran to be less aggressive, we can't pretend that there isn't a cost associated with that limited goal.
Confusion yesterday in the Department of Defense, where you had a letter that was released to the media or leaked to the media that appeared to be from the U.S. general to the Iranians saying that we're going to respect your decision to kick us out and we're going to be repositioning the troops. A lot of scrambling around for several hours, real confusion and chaos. And then finally, the Department of Defense coming out and saying this was all a mistake. We don't intend to do this. And the president saying, damn right, we're not going to be doing this. In fact, I'm going to impose massive sanctions on the Iraqis if, in fact, they kick us out of the country. How did any sense of how something like that could go so wrong? I mean, it seems to be the kind of thing that you really want to get right.
You would think so. Never seen anything like it.
Nobody has.
The closest parallel I have is when I was working at the agency, a message was sent to a foreign government that included the name of someone that was not on a delegation, that was a trip to go to that country for a certain interaction. And the person was mentioned who was not going on that trip. And the after effects of that were huge. The whole office was in a tizzy, and people were going nuts about this. Here we have an actual document announcing, in a sense, the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country, and it's not even complete. Now, that I go in two directions from that. One is that there's such a frenetic atmosphere that this was an honest mistake, that this was a working draft that was, and somebody just made a mistake in the flurry of activity. The other possibility is that somebody actually leaked it, that somebody wanted this out there to show that this was being considered as a result of what happened. I don't like that. I think deliberations within the government about actions to take, even in response to its own perhaps short-sighted actions, need to be protected. And putting that out there is a way of either forcing the hand of others in the government or of just showing the kind of attitude within the decision-making that would be wrong. I'm not sure it happened. I don't have information that it was leaked as opposed to being a mistake. But if it was, that's disturbing.
So the former Secretary of Defense, William Perry, tweeted out, and this is actually terrifying to hear this from a former Secretary of Defense, "Anyone who ever doubted that miscommunication could escalate a situation as far as triggering an accidental nuclear war need only to look at the chaos currently on display before a war has even begun. The digital era does not safeguard us from human error." It does not safeguard us, it accelerates the human error. And also, that was interesting, Tim Alberta tweeted out that, you know, almost every Trump voter that he met in 2016 said it was time for somebody to run government like a business, efficient, responsive, etc. This is the underlying failure of Trump's presidency. The government is a mess. No CEO could keep their job amid such chronic turmoil and dysfunction. Will he? And he was commenting on the incompetence that's going on here. And I guess that this is also the overlay that even among folks who want to take a stronger line with Iran and who support the targeting of General Soleimani, the fact that Donald Trump is quote-unquote in charge is still disturbing because, as you point out, it's not clear there's a strategy. It's not clear that he understands how to calibrate the tactics. And we're not sure who he's listening for and right. whether or not he's able to calculate all of the consequences of his action. So it is possible to have two ideas in your mind at the same time, to think that maybe these policies are defensible, but terrified that they are being implemented by this president.
Yeah, let's play out an alternate history here. Let's say that the president of the United States had the option in front of him of targeting Soleimani. And let's posit that there also was an imminent threat by whatever definition is accepted within the national security planning. And the president gets together, you know, the Gang of Eight from Congress and says, "I'm about to conduct this strike for this reason. Here is the bottom line intelligence assessment driving it. Here's the policy deliberation." He doesn't even have to do that, but let's say he did. And then he did the strike. Now, we could still have the same conversation about whether it was a wise policy. And perhaps then in the political sphere, there would be that debate. That's perfectly fine. But we would not be having the same concerns about the president and how this happened. Because at that point, you have, if not buy-in, you have notification of Congress in a timely fashion, and you're letting them know why it's happening instead of having it happen and then coming up with justifications afterwards that, frankly, do differ. What we're hearing from Pompeo and Esper and other sources are not on the same page, which implies at least that they did not work off of some interagency memo that provided the legal and policy justification for the strike as it happened. If we would have had that alternate history, Charlie, we would be having a different conversation now. We could still talk about whether this is in the long-term interest of the United States, but we could say, if you're going to have a momentous action in the national security space, that's the way you want it to happen in our system.
Now, there's also the irony that overlays all of this, and I hesitate to say this next sentence, but Tucker Carlson has a point. You have the Trump world has spent the last several years questioning the veracity and the competence and the honesty of the intelligence community. But now on this particular issue, it's like, forget all of that. The deep state is completely credible. We need to follow what they're doing. Why should we question that? And it is funny watching on Fox some of the hosts who have, spent hours and hours and hours talking about the deep state, suddenly deciding that, well, no, the intelligence community is clearly right about this, even though we don't know exactly what they said.
Yeah, to me, it was absolutely stunning when I saw that, given what some of those same platforms have been saying over and over and over again since 2016 about the deep state intelligence and how it's unreliable and it's not useful. To me, it was like a rebirth of irony, which I thought had died 3 years ago, but it returned from the grave briefly for that moment when intelligence was being praised on Fox News, only to have its life mercilessly clubbed out of it forevermore. Because irony is, we've lapped irony, what, four times now in terms of whether we can actually recognize something as such. To me, if they now believe, and this would be a stretch, but if pundits now believe that, yes, if there was intelligence supporting this strike, we have faith in the intelligence community again, great. We should have had faith in the intelligence community from the beginning, because there's many people doing their best to provide the best assessments to policymakers, regardless of their party, for the sake of national security. That's the case on Russia. That's the case on China. And that's certainly the case on Iran, too.
You know, a reporter called me yesterday and was asking about the way the conservative media is covering this and whether or not I was surprised by the strong support among, conservative, leaning media for this action, despite the fact that Donald Trump had run on a somewhat isolationist, not getting involved in endless wars platform. And I said, no, I mean, there's several things here. Number one, most conservatives as a default setting like a vigorous, muscular foreign policy. That's number one. The overlay on that, of course, is the reflexive support of everything that Donald Trump does. And then, of course, there's always the fallback position of anti-Trumpism, which is that you may question Trump, but you can find somebody on the left like Colin Kaepernick to attack. But I also think that it is this weird moment where, remembering that Trumpism is fundamentally isolationist, but it's also militaristic. That he likes to, on the same hand, say that we don't want to project American power, get involved in endless wars, but he's fully prepared to rattle the saber of killing bad guys. Bad guys who, by the way, represent countries that do not have nukes, which may be consequential in the long run. I mean, one of the things, the Iranians got to be sitting around thinking, he would never have done this to a Russian or a North Korean. Maybe we should be a nuclear power as well. But it is this sort of, consciously, and I don't want to say macho, but it is this consciously sort of brutalist approach that we will kill people, commit war crimes, destroy things at the same time that the president is telling people that, it's America first and we're not going to be, the shining city on the hill for, human rights. You follow what I'm getting at here? That these are not necessarily contradictory in the minds of Trump supporters.
No, and it points out that when you have a very simple mantra like America first, mm-hmm. or make America great again, you can refer anything back to that. You could say we're, America first because we're not doing targeted strikes around the world like we used to, because we're going to focus on home. Or you can say America first because we're taking out someone like Soleimani to protect American lives. And everyone who supports the president, and many who do not, can say, yes, I will agree with that. That happens to be in the interest of the United States. Or they can say, no, it doesn't. But it's not a guiding principle to say America first, because look at the divergent policies between NATO and Saudi Arabia, or between China and Turkey, or between the Philippines and Canada. It is not a guiding principle when it is up to the whims of the president and his right. personality and mood every day.
And this is also a reminder that the president does not really believe in American exceptionalism and does not really understand the culture of the American the American military. And, you know, two things. You know, American exceptionalism means we don't behave the same way as international thugs and terrorists. So the Taliban and ISIS may destroy cultural institutions. We do not do that. We represent something different. He really has bought into the sort of cultural relativism. Well, yes, we kill lots of people too. The kind of line that conservatives would have universally rejected a few years ago. And then he also his failure to understand the real sense of honor of the U.S. military, his enthusiasm for war crimes, which has been on display over and over again during the campaign, you know, in his comments, that he believes that in war, basically, whatever the war fighters do is acceptable. He will have their back. He sent the signal that if they murder people, if they torture people, that he might intervene and pardon them. You know, his comments yesterday about the targeting of the cultural institutions. This is also something that really defies the traditions and the honor of the U.S. military. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, that tension.
Yeah. And it's funny, the mantra of America First really isn't that. That's what's purported to be the guiding principle. But the real guiding principle is might makes right,
right,
in the prescriptive sense. And usually that's used pejoratively. It's used to say that, you know, might makes right is a horrible thing, and ethically that doesn't add up. But it's almost like might makes right is being championed as the proper policy.
Okay, so John Bolton has brought impeachment back. As of 24 hours ago, you could sit here and say, what's happening in Iran has pushed impeachment off the front pages. Well, it's back on the front pages because the president's former national security advisor is saying, yeah, I've been thinking about it. And, you know, if I am subpoenaed by the Senate, I am willing to testify. It is not at all clear whether that, in fact, is going to happen, though, is it?
No. And I don't even know what Bolton's game is at this point. On the one hand, he seems to have no love lost for his former boss. And he is a well-known bureaucratic fighter. And I would not put it past him if he were basically saying, you know what, I feel like I was treated wrongly and I have a lot of goods to deliver. So I want to tell my story and I will do that if asked. On the other hand, Bolton is not stupid. And I don't think he expects that he will be called to testify in the Senate. Mm-hmm. I think he adds up the political the votes the way that many pundits are. And he may be putting that out there as a way of saying, oh, I really wish I could. And if I were asked, I would. But the House has already done doing it. So it's got to be in the Senate. And well, if the Senate doesn't see to me doing it, then I'll just have to tell my story later on in a book or in an exclusive interview somewhere.
This is great minds think alike, because I gamed this out in my newsletter this morning and came to the same conclusion here. I mean, everybody is assuming that, well, he's going to go and he'll have this devastating testimony, which he's capable of doing because he knows stuff. He was at the meetings. He took extensive notes. He does have this axe to grind. But this might be that calculated bluff, you know, that, this canny Washington player makes an offer that he knows they're going to refuse. At least based on what I'm seeing, the quote unquote Republican moderates do not appear to be willing to buck McConnell. I think this raises the pressure on them. And I think that they're going to pay a huge political price for doing it. But John Bolton right now does not have a lot of incentives to be the John Dean of the Trump administration. His career in conservative politics would be over. It would take place in the midst of a war that he has devoutly wished for, right? So I think his best case scenario is he offers to testify, GOP blocks his testimony in its rush to acquit Trump, and then he comes out with his big blockbuster best-selling book later on. He can, you know, still be viable, but I feel like that's excessively cynical, but that cynicism is hard won.
Yeah, and I'll play out the game several steps down the road. Imagine what happens. I don't think this is likely, but imagine what happens. He makes clear that he's willing to answer a subpoena and answer questions. That doesn't mean he's going to answer all questions.
Mm-hmm.
So he could show up and then assert a very broad privilege and say, nope, I cannot answer these questions. Now, that could go into a court and take months and months, and he probably would have to answer many questions, but that could still gum up the process. let's go the other way. Let's say he would actually answer almost all questions, and he wants to in the Senate, but the Senate doesn't do it. There's nothing to prevent the House from drawing up new articles of impeachment based on new evidence. Clearly, they don't want to. They thought this was their chance. But there is no reason, whether it's the president committing war crimes or even threatening to commit war crimes, or getting new evidence from the National Security Advisor that points to exactly what the president said and did, to either fortify an existing article or just draw up a new article and forwarding that to the Senate. Again, these are unlikely scenarios, but there's a lot in the future that could happen if Bolton is willing to talk, or at least says he is, because he can't go out there and say, yes, I'm willing to obey a subpoena in the Senate, but I'm not in the House. It doesn't quite work that way. Either you're claiming you can't talk about any of this, or you're not.
So speaking of impeachment, this is a good segue, because you have a very provocative piece in the Washington Post this morning, making some, I would say, some interesting, shall we, creative suggestions for impeachment. And the heart of your argument is that the founders may have made a mistake in putting the power of trying an impeachment in the hands of the Senate.
I've been thinking about this a lot as I've been looking in the last month or so at what's going on in the Senate. And I tried to remember exactly what happened in the Clinton impeachment. So I've been reading up on that. And then I went back to look at cases of history going back to the 1800s involving cases of presidential impeachment.
Yeah, could I mention that you've actually written the book on this, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. So you haven't just been thinking about it. You wrote the book about this. So
I did. Yeah. And getting to know that history let me know that the founders got a lot right. I mean, we are very blessed that we're in a system that was so forward-looking in terms of balancing competing interests and separation of powers. But they got some things wrong. I mean, and if you think the founders are flawless and we can't change anything, then guess what? We have to go back to slavery, because they had a constitution that took account of that. One of the things they got wrong was putting impeachment trials for presidents in the Senate. I'm not necessarily opposed to impeachment trials for other senior executive branch officials being in the Senate, because after all, the Senate is the body that confirms those officials, and there's some justice in them determining whether these people have committed high crimes and misdemeanors that enable them to be removed. But for presidents, the Senate is a horrible place, perhaps the worst place for an impeachment to be tried, because it is an inherently partisan institution. To be fair, the founders didn't know that. To be fair, the founders didn't pass various presidential succession laws that most often have had the president pro tempore of the Senate in the line of succession, meaning one of the senators is actually voting either to put himself in the presidency, which would have happened if Andrew Johnson would have been removed from office. We would have had a senator who is essentially voting himself into the White House, or now putting himself higher up in the line of succession because of the new presidential succession we have. Either way, it's inherently an interested party voting in a very momentous case. So I started to think, you know, that's what we've always known in this country. That's what the system is, and anything else just feels wrong.
Right.
So I was talking with Jared Cohen, who's an adjunct fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Accidental Presidents, so a nerd on presidential history like me. We were working on another project, and he brought up this, and we started thinking about it and said, you know what? Other countries don't all do it in their equivalent of the Senate. Some of them do it in the highest court of the land. So we could have the Supreme Court judge impeachments of the president. Romania, for example, sends it to a public referendum and says the people really should decide. Italy does something really strange. They create a special court that includes 15 members of their high court, and then they take 16 Italian citizens who are not part of the government, and they add them in to make a 31-person court. So if we think the Senate is the only way of doing it, we're just putting blinders on. There are other ways that avoid this partisan circus that we're seeing. And frankly,
there's not going to be a groundswell of, there's not going to be a groundswell of support to emulate Romania and Italy, though.
Not so much, but there's certainly not going to be any enthusiasm, even among senators, for impeachment trials to be in the Senate. Reading the history of the Clinton impeachment, they were doing everything possible they could to avoid having not only a long trial, but in many cases, to just be done with the whole matter without a trial. you hear the same things now. When you hear the speaker, I'm sorry, when you hear the Senate majority leader saying he is not impartial and he's going to coordinate with the White House, when you have other senators saying they've already made up their mind and there's nothing they could hear that would change their mind, that is not the impartial equivalent of a jury that the founders had in mind when they put the Senate in charge of trying presidential impeachment. So it's more of a thought piece to say,
Well, this
is not going to happen now, but for the future, we've had plenty of cases where laws have been passed that say this will take effect after the next presidency or the next election cycle. So getting away from this partisan circus we're in every time there's an impeachment or a potential impeachment, it's just me foot stomping the idea that the Senate is not a good place to do this.
No, I think it's a good thought experiment, and it's also a reflection of the fact that the system feels broken. You know, on yesterday's podcast, I was talking with Kim Whaley, who's also a constitutional scholar, and she's talking about the problem of the Senate not being self-enforcing. If in fact the key players do not assert their powers, rights, and prerogatives, then the whole system does fall apart. You do wonder whether or not, clearly the founders did not see the hyper-partisanship tribalization that we're having right now. They certainly would not have imagined that members of the Senate and the House would have been so willing to surrender their powers and their prerogatives to an all-powerful executive. They would have assumed that there would have been the jealousies between the branches. But you wonder whether you can actually come up with any sort of a system that will work given the kinds of tribalism and the current, maybe the problem isn't the system. Maybe the problem's us, is what I'm getting at. That if we have an uninformed, unengaged, public that sees everything through a tribal lens, then maybe there is no design that's going to save
us. There is no good solution, at least that I was able to think about and bouncing around with some others. There's nothing that is an obvious solution, or frankly, you would hope that over 200 plus years of history, we would have tried it. There isn't a great answer to this, especially in a more tribal political age. But the Senate clearly is not the best option, because we are seeing people running away from their responsibility to do this. The fact that they take a separate oath for impeachment and that they swear to be impartial, and that they, in a sense, become a very special court. They are no longer a legislative body. That sounds really good in theory, and I have no doubt that a few senators in history, and maybe not more than a few, but a few senators have taken that seriously and somehow had the psychological makeup that they could do that. But it's putting a big burden on senators who, many of them, have worked their whole life in a partisan political environment to tell them that they should flip a switch and suddenly become the equivalent of an impartial juror. That's just not something they're used to, unlike perhaps judges who typically do that.
This is a very interesting point, because there's a price to be paid for going through forms that everybody understands is a farce. Because what the senators are going to stand up there, they are going to swear that oath, and then they're going to turn around and they're going to go to their cable television station of their choice and basically say, yeah, well, of course I'm not impartial. Well, of course I've already made up my mind. So, there's a price to be paid for having laws that are ignored, or laws that people think are immoral or ineffectual. And I think that there's a price to be paid for, watching the leading politicians in America swear an oath that nobody takes seriously. I mean, there's another corrosive. One of those blows that we take.
It's absolutely corrosive. And again, none of these options are necessarily good. Each of the ideas I put out there in the Washington Post has its own problems, many of them very serious ones. But the idea is to shine a light on the fact that the Senate is probably the worst place to try presidential impeachments. And we need to hold senators to a higher standard, because frankly, it is there, and that's not going to change anytime soon. So we need to use this as an excuse to say, hey, senators, look, you have a constitutional role that is different than your legislative process. You are not legislators when you are trying the president. You are a special court for that purpose, and you had better treat that seriously.
Well, the piece is extremely provocative. The founders put presidential impeachment trials in the Senate. They were wrong. By David Priest in this morning's Washington Post. David, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast again. It is always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.